The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Again, as I said last time, this is, if you want to feel good about having text in front of you, it's basically two words, lo tignov. There is an interesting discussion, right, which is very challenging. If you look at the Medrash, and you look at the Gemara, right, the Talmud, it has a very specific piece of theft, which it claims, which it suggests is what this commandment is really talking about, which is, right. In other words, the Talmud says that lo tignov here specifically refers to kidnapping. In other words, gnevat nefesh. In other words, it's not just if you steal, if you walk into a store and you rip off a candy bar, you know, or that one, you know, if we were willing to go around this table, we won't do it because we don't embarrass anybody. I would imagine that everyone here, whether realizing it or not, it is an interesting question, has stolen in their life at some point. Doesn't mean that you walked and embezzled, doesn't mean you openly cheated and lied on your income tax, but, you know, all sorts of different thefts, right? But the Talmud, the Gemara, and the Medrash backs this up, suggests that this is a specific type of theft. So the question is why? Why is kidnapping, the theft of a human being, stealing, you know, taking someone against their will, which is a much more serious piece of this crime, why is that the specific detail that the Gemara deals with? Okay, well then that leads me to another question. In other words, what the Gemara says is that there is a theme that these were the specific, in other words, you know, there's a discussion about why 10 commandments, right? You find this discussion in different places. And one of them is in the Gemara in Sanhedrin that talks about why you need 10 commandments, right? The Ramban, Nachmanides, has a whole discussion on this. Why do you need 10 commandments if you have 613? And so the Gemara says, these are what are called avot. In other words, you have major categories. We see this in Shabbat, right? You have a category which is don't light a fire. But there are all sorts of subcategories that stem from not lighting a fire. For example, we have electricity. So the prohibition against turning on a light switch is not biblical, is not rabbinic, it's biblical. Because technically you're doing something, although that's an interesting discussion for another time, but technically you're doing something which relates to lighting a fire, if that's true, right? So the Torah doesn't spell out for us, or more accurately, the oral tradition doesn't spell out for us all of the minor categories. It spells out the major categories. So these are major categories, right? And if these are major categories, Chazal, Jewish tradition, seems to suggest, and we've been discussing this at length, that every one of these major categories will lead you to all of the subcategories somehow that exist in Jewish tradition. So one way of analyzing these major categories is that these are capital offenses. And that may be true. But that would still lead us to another question. Number one, why is it that stealing a person? In other words, I could understand that walking into a store, right? In fact, yesterday on the news, there was this whole scare. Some bright woman left her infant, 2-month-old baby, in a baby seat up by the counter while she went off somewhere in the department store shopping with her toddler. Disappeared for... Pardon? I don't know. It was like 15, 20 minutes, and somebody at the counter noticed this baby and thought that someone had abandoned the baby. They called the police. When the woman finally came back up to the front of the department store, right? So, yeah, she's being charged for criminal negligence and child abuse and whatever, right? And I want you to know, coming from Israel, there is such a heightened sensitivity to these issues here. In other words, someone listening to this story in Israel would never really understand this story. I don't understand. Because, no, the first thing they would say is, I don't understand. If she's in the store shopping, why didn't they just find her? It's only when I got here that I discovered why, like, you come to these huge stores, like you're in a Walmart, you have no idea who's in the store. It's like a city in there. So I can understand a person goes and they think it's a second and they turn around. I'm not saying it's not negligence, right? But people here are very sensitive to this. And because there's such an issue of kidnapping, you know, so they call the police and everything else, right? You never know exactly what's going on. So I can understand that that's a serious crime. And I can understand that you do tremendous damage to someone. But why is that particularly the capital offense? In other words, I can understand that if you take a life, right? So then you should give a life. So that's a capital offense. There's a logic to that. What is it about theft that fits in here? right? That's number one. So it's worth discussing. And number two is that these are, and we're really going to see this as we move forward, because the last three really sort of make this point. These are not just 10 mitzvot. It's not just, you know, if you have a set of fruit trees and, you know, you mix them up, you can't eat the fruit because you're breeding hybrids. This is a major category in Judaism. And that means that this has to tie into the basic themes that Judaism are about. And it has to tie in, by the way, to the other themes, which are really all one theme that we've seen in the Aseret HaDibrot. So let's think about this for a minute, okay? First of all, what is theft? How do I define theft? And second of all, where else do I see theft? Because if you take a close look, you begin to see that theft is the underlying issue that introduces almost everything in the Torah, and certainly at the beginning in Bereshit, right? So the first thing that's interesting is that people don't realize, and this has been my experience, just how rampant theft really is. Because there are lots of different things that you can steal. I'll give you an example. And this is probably the most serious, although people don't recognize it this way. What would you say is the most serious type of theft? If you could pick one type of theft, stealing something from someone, what would be the most serious type of theft?
Going on one horse. Not stupid, but today maybe a bad day. Sort of like in the realm of character assassination, to take away somebody's reputation.
To steal someone's reputation?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because you can't.
It's interesting, by the way, the Gemara suggests that that's learned out from Lo Tignov. In other words, character assassination, which we discussed relative to Lo Tirtzach, specifically is about embarrassment. Stealing someone's reputation is specifically related to Lo Tignov. It's an interesting discussion. But that's not what the Gemara says is the most serious type of theft. And that would also be something that I would think. Gnevat Da'at is a very interesting type of theft. If you walk into a bookstore, you're standing at a bus stop, and it's raining outside, right? And you want to come in from the rain. Okay? So there's a bookstore there. So you walk into the bookstore, and the person behind the counter comes over and says, "Can I help you?" What do you say? Not only are you supposed to say no, you're actually supposed to ask permission, halachically speaking. You're supposed to ask permission to say, "Look, I have no intention of buying a book. It's just raining outside. Do you mind if I stand in your store?" Now, any intelligent shopkeeper will say yes, because they'll hope that while you're standing there, you'll notice a book and you'll pick it up. But you can't give the person the assumption that you're interested in buying a book, because that's called gnevat da'at. We do all sorts of gnevat da'at.
But by saying, "I'm just looking."
Pardon?
By saying, "I'm just looking."
Right, you're doing the same thing.
But it's you're saying the truth.
Right, if you say that you're just looking, or, you know, no thank you, right? But what if you say, "I'm just looking," and you have no intention of looking? You go into Tiffany's and you know that there is nothing in that store that you could possibly afford, and you have no interest in affording it, right? You go in there because, I don't know, because it's pretty, or you go in there because you want to learn things about jewels so that one day you could surprise your wife and buy something, which I'm not dumb enough to try to do, right? But, right? So that's gnevat da'at. Gneva is theft. Dat is knowledge, relationship. Pardon?
Even if you're looking, you can look, it is pretty.
Well, that's a very interesting question. What does it mean you're looking? It's a very complex issue, because the truth is that the merchant today wants you to look. Mm-hmm. It's good for business for his store that there are people in the store. And many merchants will tell you they don't mind that there's... I just had this conversation with someone. They don't mind. There's a fellow in the shul, I forget his name, and he has like a jewelry store or runs something like that. And I asked him this question, you know, because I figured it's an interesting topic for her. And he said that if people walk by a store and they see six or seven people looking in the window, they get a subliminal message that there's stuff in there worthwhile, and they walk in. So he wants browsers. It's good for business to have browsers, which is fascinating to me. So there's this whole sort of symbiotic relationship going on where I'm using you and you're using me. Now, Judaism has an issue with this, because how do you, on the one hand, keep things above board? You don't want to be using other people. You want to be honest about it. On the other hand, if everybody knows what's going on, then it is honest. Very complicated issue. But that is not, and of course there are more serious issues of gnevat da'at. You know, you want to go see, somebody just told me that they were doing this, that they came down here and they wanted to get a sense of the community. So they figured the best way to get to learn about a community was they called them a broker. And they went around with this person for an entire day on Sunday, and looking at houses, right? And this person, you know, they can't afford these houses. They're not interested in houses. They just want to get a sense of the community. And they said it was fun. They got to see all these houses. And they told the broker, you know, well, our budget is like $1.5 million. And this woman wasted her entire Sunday, I imagine. And yet, I want you to know that my wife did real estate. And I asked her this question. And she said it didn't bother her because the truth is that every time you take someone around and you see houses, right, you learn something new about the houses. The owners who own the houses, they want to feel that you're bringing people by. So you're helping. So this guy feels like he used the person. And after I finished telling, you know, that that's terrible, you also have to realize that the real estate agents aren't stupid. In other words, if they have a $4 million house and they don't bring anybody by for 6 months, they're going to have a problem. They'd be much happier bringing somebody by every week until they finally find somebody, even if the person... It's a very complicated issue.
Yesterday, I don't enjoy it.
It's a very complicated issue. How do you arrive at the solution? How do you know when you're doing Gnevat Da'at or not? But that is not the one that the Talmud says is the most serious. What is the most serious form of Gneva, of theft? And this fascinates me. Land would be interesting. Land is actually one of the most complicated things to steal. You know, and in a minute we're going to see why. Well, what's interesting about land is that I can't tell you that I went through all of Jewish source material. That would make me much older. But I could tell you that in sort of as much as I was able to look through the major tractates on Gneva, I could not find a significant discussion about the theft of land. And I have a theory as to why. I'm not sure if I'm right or not. Okay, but we'll get to that. So don't even forget that. But land actually is almost a non-issue. In other words, obviously if you steal land, you're stealing. But the Gemara doesn't use that as an example, which makes me wonder whether that's not a serious issue. In other words, like land, yeah, people might steal it, don't worry about it. Which got me thinking as to why that is. Why is the Gemara less concerned about land? What is it that is the most significant form of theft? It's mentioned three times in the Gemara.
Like a husband.
Well, that's adultery. That's lo tinaf. But by the way, that would help us to understand why, I mean, we haven't gotten there, why this progression. In other words, murder is stealing a life. Adultery is stealing relationships, right? Here we're stealing property. Only we're not stealing property, we're stealing a life. So which is it? Anybody? Someone's olam haba. Ah, that's interesting. Well, that happens all the time. You can't really steal someone's olam haba, if you think about it. Oh, that's interesting. That you shouldn't put a stumbling block before someone. Although you should know that that issue of not putting a stumbling block in front of someone, like for example, if I know you're trying to quit smoking, okay, and let's assume for the moment that there are all sorts of halakhic discussions about whether you're allowed to smoke and when you're allowed to smoke. And I personally think all the poskim would talk about the fact that you can't make it prohibited to smoke. We're smokers, but then I found out Rav Moshe wasn't a smoker. But anyway. If you know someone's trying to quit smoking and you smoke in front of them, are you guilty of more than just smoking? Are you becoming a stumbling block to them? So I think, this is a theory again, I think that the reason that you have an issue is not because he is any less liable. It's not because you took his, let's say whatever, we'll call it the Olam Haba, right? It's not because you took his future away. He did that to himself. Your issue is your insensitivity in being a part of the process, but it doesn't mean he's not. If I leave a wallet out on the desk and you're a kleptomaniac, it doesn't make you any less liable. It just involves me. And you could look at it the other way, right? But no. Should I tell you what it is? Very interesting. Last guesses? No? Sleep. Stealing someone's sleep. I was sure you were going to get this. Right.
We just talked about it. Wait, you just said what
the Gemara says. The Gemara says that there's one type of theft for which a person can lose their chelek and olam haba, which you can lose your portion of the world to come, and that is depriving someone of sleep.
But babies do it all the time.
So what's interesting about this, if you think about it, and I didn't have enough time to think about it, so maybe it will prove me wrong. Sleep is the one thing that if you take, you cannot give it back. You can't give back a person's sleep.
But you can create another opportunity.
But that'll just be another opportunity. This is not our topic, but there are certain personalities, and I know them well because I'm one of them, that are what you call cram personalities. You know, like when I study for tests, when I was doing some, I was not capable of sort of gradually studying every day 3 hours and just the last day before the test having only 3 hours to study. I would just inevitably let it pile up and then I would cram, you know, for the week before and the night before. I'd be up till 3 a.m, whatever it would be, right? And there's some people who do that with their lives. In other words, like, you know, they know they have the project, right? I don't know, cooking for Shabbos. Some people, and believe me, this is not my topic to even comment on, so I'm just using this as an example, not a judgment. There's no right or wrong here, but you know, some people, they're just capable of knowing that Yom Tov is coming and cooking 20 minutes a day for 3 weeks in advance. Of course, they have to have an extra fridge, right? right. And some people, they just, for whatever the reason, the day before, they're just in the kitchen all day slaving over the stoves, right? So that's a crammed personality. You know, some people have like 20 hours of meetings to get everything done, email, whatever it is in your life that you do, right? And some people do that with sleep. You know, you sleep 2-3 hours a night or 4 hours a night, but then like Shabbos comes and Baruch Hashem and you make it up and you cram it in. And they have discovered, you know, that you can't do that with sleep. In other words, if you sleep 8 hours a night, okay, for 7 days a week, which is 56 hours, if I'm not mistaken, right? It's not the same as sleeping those same 56 hours over the course of 2 days, right? It's just not the same. You can't make it up, and it actually affects your body. So you can never make up loss of sleep. And I wonder if that's true in general about time. In other words, what Gnevat Da'at really about is taking someone's time. So put this aside as a moment. Why is it that land you don't really find as much involved? Why is sleep so significant, right? And what is theft in general? So how would you define theft? If you had to come up with a line, there's an obvious line. What does it mean to steal? Taking something that doesn't belong to you. Now let me ask you a question. How do you define something as belonging to you? And understand this.
But you can steal from your own sleep.
Pardon?
You can steal to yourself about the sleep. So.
But at least if you steal from yourself, you can make it up to the victim. Like, you know, you know. What's interesting to me is, you know, I'll give you an example. We were up in Cape Canaveral, right? Finally went. I said, we have to get the kids up there before we go. Great experience, a lot of learning. Anyway, and it was a wonderful trip, and at the end, we pull into a gas station just to, you know, fill up the gas, and the car just dies. Right? We're up there in Port Wubawaka, I don't know, whatever it is, up there 15 minutes from the Space Center, and I don't even remember the name of the road, in this little Chevron station, and, you know, we started the car, but it just won't stay started. So we go through the, you know, who do you call, and thank God we have AAA, but, you know, and I explained to AAA over the phone, you know, it doesn't sound like the alternator, because when you start it, it actually starts, it's not the starter, it just dies, it won't stay on. So of course we wait an hour, and the guy comes, and here's my story, and says, nope, it's not the alternator, right? Thank you very much. Exactly. Then we go through the, where do we take it to a garage, and we finally decide that we're going to, you know, take it all the way down, right? And tow it down, and blah, blah, blah. So, how do you look at a situation like that? I'm putting aside the issue of like the moderni and the recognition of good, and with all the things that could go wrong with a car, that should be the problem. Baruch Hashem, kids are healthy, thank God it happened. At the end of vacation, you know, whether you're just fooling yourself and rationalizing to yourself, or whether you really tap into that is irrelevant to me. Thank God it's in a gas station, there's Coca-Cola for the kids, you know, whatever it is, right? But you think that you've lost this time, right? You were going to get home at 7 o'clock in the evening, and now you're going to get home at 2 in the morning. But you didn't lose that time, because if Hashem runs the world, you were not meant to have that time. This is just the way in which you didn't have that time. Right? You have, I remember when we were first married, right? And we were buying some wall unit, whatever it was. And I had saved up money. And it was really the only real piece of furniture we bought. And I even remember to this day, it was $1,200. And I had $1,200 cash, which for us was a huge amount of money. And we finally found this big wool unit, and we looked over, and it was great, and we were going to ship it to Israel. And I get down there, and I reach in my pocket, and it's gone. $1,200 cash. Did I drop it? Did it get pickpocketed, etc.? Just shows you that I still remember the amount of money, and this is 15 years later, right? I was not meant to have the $1,200, right? Because if I was meant to have that $1,200, I would have had the $1,200. I wasn't meant to have it. So now, did it ever really belong to me? I mean, if Hashem really runs the world, what does it mean that I own anything? Do I really own anything? And I'll remind you of an idea that we've spoken about before, but it's so specifically, you remember that we've spoken about words. And we talked about the fact that Hashem created the world through words. And Rav Dessler has this idea, really comes from tradition way back, that everything about the world, everything about creation, since Hashem created the world, right? It's not that Hashem created the world and one day Hashem decided to give the world the Torah. Right? And so Hashem wrote the Torah. You know, when you're in first grade, that's how you look at the Torah. That Hashem went up to Moshe and he said, we're going to write down the Torah in whatever fashion it was written down. Whether Moshe wrote it down on Sinai, whether it was gradually written down, like the Ramban says, sort of over the period of the 40 years in the desert, God wrote the Torah. That's not really an accurate, even within the limited capacity of our understanding, it's not an accurate way of understanding how we were given Torah. Because if God did write the Torah, then that means that God thought the Torah before the Torah was written, like anything else we write. And if God thought the Torah before the Torah was written, right, then that means that the Torah always was. God doesn't have a thought today that he didn't have yesterday. Because that would mean that yesterday God was less than God is today, right? So whatever comes from the thought process of God just always was. So that means that the Torah always was. The world, on the other hand, was created. The world is a physical item, which somehow Hashem brought into the world, although the idea of the existence of the world always existed. Right? So if the Torah always was and the world was created, it's not that in the world the Torah was eventually given, it's that the world was created from the Torah. The Torah is the blueprint for all of creation, because it always existed. It's the thought process of God. And therefore, says Rav Dessler, everything about creation, anything that you will ever find, is found in the Torah. And anything you don't find in the Torah is essentially an illusion. And we've spoken about this before. If you remember, I think the example I gave you was the word suffik, right? The word doubt. The word doubt does not appear. It's a very important word in Jewish law, right? Suffik to Rabbanan, the doubt about rabbinic law. Suffik to Raita, doubt about biblical law. Sfeik, sfeika, double doubt. Ein safek motzi mide vadai, that something doubtful, I can't take property from you if you're certain and I'm uncertain, etc. All over Chazal, all over Jewish law, Jewish tradition, I do not find the word safek anywhere in the Torah. Because God did not create safek. God didn't create doubt. We create doubt. God just created. We have doubt about what God created. That's, by the way, the reason that the word vadai, the word certainty, also a very important word in Jewish tradition, does not appear. The word teva, nature, which is also an issue that the philosopher, the Rabbi Yehuda Levi talks about, Maimonides talks about, doesn't appear in the Torah. Because nature is an illusion. Hashem created the world, and nature is the illusion that allows us to think that there's a natural order, and that God created nature, and nature runs the world. But nature is an illusion. God runs the world. As a matter of fact, it may well be that if you see through that illusion, and I don't know that we're on a level in this world that we're capable of doing this anymore, but it may be that one of the concepts of prophecy and of a Navi being able to perform miracles is simply that if you see through the illusion of nature, simply, that if you see through the illusion of nature, right, so then you don't need the illusion anymore. Right? It's like a witness who's on the most wanted list, who's coming to testify, and he's got a bag over his head, and you're in camera, and it's just the three of you in the courtroom, and you recognize his voice. Now the judge knows who he is, and the prosecutor knows who he is, and you don't. So as soon as you recognize his voice and you know it's Joe, he takes the bag off his head, because you don't need the bag anymore. So if you realize that nature is an illusion, what that really means is that you realize that everything is miraculous. And if everything is miraculous, right, if God exists, then miracles are only natural, right? What's the big deal if there's a miracle? If Hashem exists, of course there are miracles. And if miracles are only natural, all of nature is miraculous. And it all becomes one salad. It's just an illusion. Right? So the ultimate example of recognizing that words that do not appear in the Torah do not appear because they are some form of an illusion is the word to have. There is no Hebrew word for having. When I say the word have, what I'm stating is that this is mine. I've acquired it. It's mine. I own it. It's my property. There is no word in Hebrew for having. In fact, the way we say in modern Hebrew having is yesh li. Yesh means it is to me. This is my relationship to it. But it doesn't mean I have it. Now, think about this for a minute. This is a very interesting idea. Do I really have anything in this world? We live in a world that needs these laws, 100%.
No, but the Torah has these.
100%, because we live in the world, right, where we need boundaries. But think about this, and I want you to know, there's some issues, you know, you could ask me a question, say, is this meat kosher? I could say, you know what, this meat's kosher, right? I can give you an answer. Some questions, I don't know that we're meant to answer them, so I can't tell you that I'm there yet, maybe one day I'll get there. I can tell you where I'm at in the question. I wonder if maybe there's a difference between saying something is mine and saying something is not yours. Now here's my theory, and if we had 2 hours, we could get to this theory, but I'll just give this to you and you'll tell me what you think. what if we define something as mine, not as I own it, not that it's mine, but that for some reason Hashem has decided that right now it should be with me? That's a very different way of looking at what's mine. And I'll tell you where I learned this. I have a family that I'm close with. Their son, Danny Majid, Hashem Yikom Damo, was a very close friend, and I'll spare you all the details because I'll get all mushy. He was killed in an ambush in 1984, and I got close to his family as a result. And I noticed that his father, I had the privilege of meeting him once before his son died, you know, when he was just a normal family. He's like a shell of who he was to this day. I mean, this is now 20 years later, you know, and this boy, Danny, you know, I mean, here I am, I'm 40 years old, we have four kids, et cetera, et cetera. Danny's still 19. You know, he's still 19 in my mind. You know, we're in different spaces. And what that did to his father, et cetera. His mother, on the other hand, very strong person, with an incredible personality. It's almost like they married each other so she could be his gift to get him through this. She, Baruch Hashem, I mean, look, what do I know? You know, as much as you can from the outside perceive, she moved on. She just bounced back. She's a very positive person. She's always smiling. She's still always smiling. Him, he's got pain in his eyes. There's a dullness. There's something that's there for 20 years. Every time I see him, maybe it's just me psychologically, but every time I see him, I remember Dani. When I talk to her, it's not there. So I once asked her, you know, we got into this really deep discussion because she, every year on Yom HaZikaron, on Memorial Day, if I'm there, so I go to the kever, to the grave, just, you know, to put a rock. And one year I was there and they came. And it was before I was very close with them, so I was very uncomfortable, whatever, but she saw I was uncomfortable, so she started having this discussion with me, which is just amazing that a woman's having a discussion with you at the grave of her son on Memorial Day. And I said to her, you know, I said, I noticed that you somehow, you succeeded in putting this in its place. And I'm just so wondering how you do that. And she said, I think the difference between bereaved parents who move on and bereaved parents who don't is that some people think, I had a son, why did God take him away? And some people think, God gave me the opportunity to be with a son, but he was never really mine to begin with. That's a very different perception. So put it on a simple level. You've got $1,200 in your pocket. You know what, you're driving your car. You just got a new car. Pick a nice car. What's the name of a nice car?
Alexis, okay.
I guess we've grown up, because it used to be Mercedes, now it's Lexus, okay. So Alexis, so you've got a new SUV Lexus. Does Lexus make an SUV? They make an SUV, right? Okay. You've got a new SUV Lexus, and you pull it out of the shop, and it's all brand new, and it still smells that good smell. You know, you can get now air fresheners that smell like new cars. Unbelievable to me. I grew up, yeah. You can put an air freshener, makes it smell new, right? It used to be that you would do anything so that your mitt would stop smelling new. Now you want it to stay smelling new? Okay. So you got this new Lexus, you're pulling it out of the shop, and I don't know, some guy's loading boxes up into the third floor of his warehouse, right? And accidentally, thank God you got out to look at a sign that you couldn't read, and you turn around and your whole car, it's gone. You had it for exactly 15 minutes. So there's two ways that you could react to this day. You can say, this is a really bad day. This is like the worst day of my life, because like I just had a Lexus 15 minutes. I wish you'd never given me the Lexus, take it away. You know, I mean, who needs this? And you're depressed and you're so upset until you waited for it, until you picked it, until you're chreisnish, and you're going out with your friends because you all get to go out in your new Lexus, and now the Lexus is a piece of cardboard. Or you could walk away and say, what a bracha. What a bracha. The Sfaradim know how to do this. You know what they say? What's the word they say?
Kapara.
This will be an atonement for me. Hashem has decided to take a sacrifice to the heavens of Alexis, right?
Okay?
We know kapara.
Kapara, okay. In Brooklyn they say kapara, right? Anyway, so what does that mean? So what's the difference between the person who walks away and just feels so blessed that they weren't in the car, and the person who walks away and is so miserable that the car isn't with them? The difference is whether you really ever owned the car, and whether you really ever owned anything. You know?
Same thing.
Emerson once said, don't become attached to anything in this world. That's exactly right. Rabbi Meir was the student of Rabbi Akiva par excellence. That's a great example. And had a very tragic life on many different levels. And Bruria found out that one of their sons died. And and well, they lost three sons on three different occasions, and that's what tested them, and this is the third, and that was, in any event, she knew on Shabbat, but she didn't want to tell her husband, because what could he do? You don't do anything in terms of mourning at that point anyway. You can't bury him, you can't go see him, you can't whatever. So she didn't tell him until Havdalah went out. And there's one opinion that says that the Havdalah flame, he couldn't light the Havdalah flame. So he knew something was wrong, and another opinion says that the wind came, and that's how he knew something was wrong. And so she told him that, you know, they had lost their son, and he broke down. And she said to him, God gave us this gift to watch for a while, and now he's gone back. Right? Well, I'm making a long Gemara short. So this is very interesting. In other words, if you don't really own anything, now this is very easy to say, it's very hard to do, but imagine how different your life would be if you didn't really own anything. And by the way, I'm not just talking about the things that are obvious. Some people are able to connect to the fact that, you know, you lose a thing, okay, so move on, life is short. Even with big things like your homes, whatever. But what about the things that are really important?
You know what, I just had a thought.
That's exactly right.
For you and I to say, oh, thank God it wasn't my right arm because I'm right-handed. Or you lose both your arms. Oh, thank God I didn't lose my leg because now I can still walk.
Well, let me ask you an interesting question. Again, I want you to know. I want you to know. It's very easy to talk about it. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. I'm quite happy that Hashem doesn't want to find out how I'll react to these things, right? The closest I ever came to this experience, you know, was recognizing that the children that you're given in this world, they're given to you for a purpose, you know? And we just make these assumptions that all the things that we assume we have, the people in our lives, the relationships that we have in our lives, they're going to be there forever. Now, some of them, you know instinctively in the back of your mind that's not true. I mean, it's not the way of the world that a parent should watch their children be buried. And therefore, it is the way of the world that a child will eventually watch his parents be buried. They're not going to be there forever. And we take them for granted. The question is, do we tap into the fact that they were never really ours, that they were gifts? And what do we do with that? And if you really are able to perceive, and again, easier said than done, if you're really able to perceive that all of the things, people, relationships, persona, everything that we have, you know the best example I can think of? I don't know anything more tragic than this. You know, is Rav Soloveitchik. Soloveitchik was such a Torah scholar. It's just, it's hard to comprehend, it's hard to describe what a voluminous mind this person had, what an impact he had on the Jewish world. And just from reading his works and the few instances I had to hear his Torah and the students that I studied with, and I think he had Parkinson's at the end of his life, and he basically lost his cerebral capacity. He wasn't able to teach. And how far it went, I couldn't tell you because it wasn't my issue, and they stopped having him give shiurim, and they stopped having him. So how do you deal with that? Now, you could debate whether he had to deal with that, because I guess if you get, for example, Alzheimer's, maybe you don't know. And that's an interesting question for some other time. But what about you're the student, you're the son. You know, you mentioned Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir had a Rebbe, Rabbi Elisha ben Avuya. There's a magnificent book written by Milton Steinberg, As a Driven Leaf, which describes the process of Elisha ben Avuya, who was the member of the Sanhedrin. I mean, to be a member of the Sanhedrin is just... I mean, there aren't any rabbis who've been alive in the last 500 years, according to the Chafetz Chaim, who would be capable of being in the Sanhedrin. That's the magnitude of the scholarship, of the sterling character. And this fellow who was on the Sanhedrin, who was the teacher of Rabbi Meir, the contemporary of Rabbi Akiva, he became a heretic. So how do you feel if you're a Rabbi Meir walking alongside with him on Yom Kippur, and he's riding on a horse on Yom Kippur? How does Rabbi Meir feel that this was taken from the world, never mind from him, unless you're able to tap into the fact that it was never really yours to begin with? So, now go back to Lo Tignov. I'll tell you a very interesting thing. What is the first instance that we find stealing in the Torah?
The apple.
As mentioned. Well, it's interesting that it does not say there that it was stolen. It is essentially the source of all problems in relationships and everything, because that's the first instance. You know, you have to understand, we're going to talk about this when we get to the last Dibra. And we see this in literary styles. Beginnings set the pace. They create the paradigm of experiences. You know, beginnings are critical. They're very important. And we have to learn to pay a lot of attention to beginnings. How things begin, when they begin, how we begin them. You know, whenever students come and you know, they want advice about, you know, they're just getting married. The thing that I most often say is like the first year of marriage, and there's all sorts of mystical things written about this. The first year of marriage is enormously important, because how you and what you do during your first year of marriage has enormous impact on the rest of your lives. And you can undo the mistakes that you make in your first year of marriage, but it's much harder than undoing mistakes you made in your third year of marriage. You know, and you meet people. People sometimes, you know, they're so busy as students and doing four different jobs and all these things that they really miss the first year of marriage. And it affects them. It's a lot of work then to create what could have been created easily at that point. Even on a practical level, that's the only year of marriage that you know you're not going to have children. Right? After that, you don't know. But, you know, at least if you're doing things within the proper framework, right? So, you know, theoretically, you know, the first year of marriage, that's when you build your relationships. And that's true for the Torah as well. The beginning of the Torah sets the pace, creates the paradigm. It's like the beginning of a business interview, right? So the first instance is enormously telling in terms of every time we make mistakes in our lives. And the first instance that you ever find is Gneva, right? Is that Hashem tells us not to eat from the tree. So what does that mean? That means that tree is not for you. It's not with you. It's in the garden. It's not yours. And you go and you eat from the tree. Now it's interesting that God does not say what I would have thought would be a logical line. You ate from my tree. That's not what God says. God doesn't say you took from a tree that isn't yours. God says, why did you eat from the tree that I told you not to eat from? It's not about yours or not yours. Now where is one of the first places that you actually find, this is very interesting. It says by Abraham, "V'hochiach Avraham et Avimelech," and Avraham criticized Avimelech al odot be'er hamayim asher gazlu avde Avimelech, regarding the well of water that the servants of Avimelech took. And I was thinking about this. So you look a little more carefully, and you can look this up. It's in the 21st chapter of Bereishit. You do not find that it says that the well is Avram's. When Avram is dealing with the well, it just says he dug it. When the servants of Avimelech take the well, it says they took it. So we assume they took it from Avram. But what if Avram taps into the fact that the well is not really his? And the well is a great example. You're digging a hole in the water, in the earth.
How many did it to serve the people? He didn't feel it was his. He didn't serve the people.
Well, could it ever be yours? So I found a magnificent Or HaChaim. The Or HaChaim of Chaim Ibn Attar writes a commentary. He wrote it actually in the Old City of Yerushalayim. He says the reason that the well is the paradigm for Gneva, for stealing, it's the first time it's actually mentioned as theft, is because a well has the opportunity to teach you what theft is really all about. What do you do when you dig a well? You're on the earth. The earth isn't necessarily yours, right? But let's say it is. And you're digging a hole. So you're actually creating something that isn't there in order to reach something that always was there. You got that? I'll say that again. You're creating something that isn't there, you're making a hole, in order to reach something that always was there. The assumption is that the reason that that's something that was always there, the water underneath, is yours, is because the land is yours. But the land wasn't always yours. And if you really tap into, no pun intended, the allegory of the well, you really begin to get the fact that nothing in this world is really yours. Which brings us back to Lo Tignov. So Lo Tignov does not mean that I'm taking something that is yours. Lo Tignov means I'm taking something that isn't meant to be with me. That's a very different way of looking at the world. And if you can tap into those two ideas on a regular basis, it changes the way you live your life. Because if nothing is really yours, then the question is not, or the question never becomes about, you know, that I have it. The question becomes about, why is it here? I'll give you a great example. The first year we were here, right? So we pulled into Thornhill Green, and you know, we were still sort of new. When does Halloween fall? It's like in October?
October. Okay.
So this is like maybe 2 months that we're in the country, and really because we had a whole journey to find a place to live, which some of you know, so we were really only in the neighborhood like a week or two. So my kids really did not know anybody. They were just new in Hillel, etc., right? They certainly weren't at the stage where they were like hanging out. And they walked by one of the houses. We were walking around the neighborhood, and there's this huge pumpkin. Okay, this huge pumpkin, right? It must have been, I don't know, like 3 feet high. In retrospect, I'm sure this family was very proud of its pumpkin, right? And there was a kid sitting outside by this pumpkin. And Adi was looking at this pumpkin, and she couldn't figure it out, right? Because it didn't look actually like it was on a stoop or on whatever. It was just standing in front of the house on the grass, right? And so she looks at me, she goes, do they have trees that make pumpkins like that? You know, so put aside the fact that pumpkins don't come from trees, you know, you get to look at the world through different eyes. We got this whole discussion about pumpkins on Halloween. I don't remember the details of the discussion, but I remember that what really grabbed her was that there was this item which was completely incongruous sitting in the middle of a place that she would not expect to see it, a big pumpkin. Now, if you think about it, that's how you have to look at the world. Everything is a big pumpkin. Her perception is that if that pumpkin's there, it must be there for a reason. Why is there a pumpkin there? It must have come to the world for a reason. Ah, there's a reason, Halloween. So do we look at everything that way? You know, you walk into a store and you buy something, or your husband buys you something, or you acquire something, or you win something, or you're gifted and blessed with something, and the automatic question is not, look what I have. The automatic question becomes, now why was this given to me? What am I going to do with this? You know, it doesn't mean that you live your life not getting attached to things so that you're able to let them go, because that's not healthy either. But this perspective changes the way in which we interact with everything that we interact with. And that's the essence of Lotu Nova. Now that takes you back to two original questions. One, why is it that the Gemara, and this is just theory, I'm not saying this is the answer, why is it that the Gemara doesn't speak at all about stealing land? Or very little. Because if you could pick an example of something that's more clearly not yours, it would be land. You know, there's a medrash, such a magnificent medrash. The medrash starts, there's a Gemara in Bava Metzia, a tractate in the Talmud that says, one of the cases there, Zeh Omer Shel Avotai V'Zeh Omer Shel Avotai. Two people, two litigants come before the court, and each of them says, this is my parents, this is my father's land, right? No, it's I inherited this land. The other guy says, I inherited this land. And they have no documents. They have no witnesses. Neither of them can prove that they lived on the land a period of time. So what does the court do? So in the Gemara, there's a whole resolution. You know, do they split it? Do they not split it? Whatever they do, right? In the Medrash says that the court, the rabbi, who I guess must have been the original Hasidic Rebbe, this is 2,000 years ago, says, listen, you come to me and you say it's yours, it's your inheritance, but you have no proof. And you come to me and you say it's yours and you have no proof. So I listen to you, and I listen to you, and I don't know what to do. Let's ask the land. And in the Medrash, right, that's exactly the sense I get, because this Rebbe, whatever, bends down and cups his ear, right? Some kafo cups his ear to the land to listen to what the land has to say. Now, I imagine at this point the two litigants are looking at this dayan, at this judge, thinking they came to the wrong judge. This guy's a few shares short, right? But he bends out down and he straightens himself up and he says, the land says it's not yours, and it's not yours. You're its. Ki me'afar ata ve'afar tashuv. You are created from the ground, the pasuk says in Breshit when Adam is created, and you will return to the ground. So land is the ultimate example of an opportunity to recognize that we don't really own anything in this world. And that may also be why the prime example of Lo Tignov here is Gnevat Nefesh, is kidnapping. Because ultimately, if everything that we have in this world is just with us, and the question is what we do with it, the ultimate example of that is our lives. We're given our lives, we are who we are for a reason. And we have to figure out what that reason is. And anything that we do that takes us away from what we're meant to do is essentially a form of Gnevat Nefesh. We're stealing who we're meant to be. And that, Bezrat Hashem, will lead us to the next one, which is what Sheker and Lotan Evrechai, Sheker and false testimony is all about. But we've hit the button zone.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212 212- 877-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.